Philosophy 10, May 12, 1954.
We'll be asked again in some connection. And I shall be very agreeable if you have a favorite hero like Beethoven or Mozart or Rembrandt or Raphael. Some such question on any one hero of your own liking, with the Ten Commandments, will also be asked. That is your private preparation. So this is clear. These two pamphlets you better read right away. Do them in the next week or the next fortnight, not just in the last days. Today I want to tell you some very simple facts about the academies. Gentlemen, we have an Academy of Science in this country, but it's very late. It's only our 19th century. The first academies, they are founded in Florence. In Florence, in the middle of the 15th century, as the center of the new Platonism. Academy and Plato are one. All those of you who have written a paper on Plato know exactly why they are one. Plato founded the Academy. And may I remind you, and this I should like to stress once more because I don't think all of you have understood it. Plato invented the Academy, but he did not found a university. Will you take this, all this down what I say pedantically, because these are formulas which you just have to have down on paper. Plato invented the Academy, but he did not found a university. A Platonic Academy is not a university, because it does not expose the mind of the student to opposite convictions of different people on the dubious. The Academy is continuation of the mastermind, Plato. On the other hand, gentlemen, the Academy is not a school, because it doesn't dismiss all its members into life as in a grammar school, as you think of a school, but the idea of the Academy is between a university and a mere school. It is an institution of higher learning, but it is not the medieval university. Why? Because Plato learned in a bitter struggle with all his enemies, the city of Athens, the tyrant of Sicily, that he could not teach princes, kings, or democracy, but that he had to hand over his wisdom to other teachers. So the Academy is the teaching of teachers, of scholars, who remain by themselves and who wait and have to abide their time, because never is the group of the day capable of receiving the highest in education. This country has neither an academy today nor a university, because it is time-serving. You always want, you are only interested in the bomb because it can be made and thrown. Now, the people in Europe who developed the idea of mass and energy, like Einstein, were quite satisfied to think about this, and if it had taken another 50 years, wouldn't have mattered. They begin to think about it in 1500. You don't understand that, gentlemen, because you don't have the academic spirit, but you have the salesman spirit. You are only interested in that what sells. That's an end product, what sells. But that's the line of thought, gentlemen, that goes into the cohesive work of any science, that goes on over centuries. It cannot be applied right away. And you must allow me to tell you, give you this warning, that the United States of America are not a sovereign country mentally, or scientifically, or autonomously. The bomb has not been made by Americans. That's not true. It has been bought by Americans. Bribed, coaxed. You have taken people, for example, in 45, the leading German physicists have flown them here, put them to work. You can always get these people as slave workers, but you cannot say that this is American work. This goes into all niches of America's industry. Only to warn you that we are not an autonomous country to this day. My own nephew had to become a carpenter in England, a skilled worker there. And when he came to this country, he was a very important person at the age of 18 because he had to fill a job in a factory in Chicago for the form, for founder, for casting, which is a very difficult, very important, always the heart of any foundry, steel foundry, is the workshop where the forms, the models in wood are made. He was able to do this. Now what did he find then when he was 18? There was a 70-year-old Swede whom he succeeded. There was no American in between. The Swede had come to this country, had learned the trade in Sweden, and he had learned it in England. And that was the tradition of the central and most skillful part of the factory in Chicago. Do you see how frail this civilization is? You must understand this, gentlemen, it's the same with science. You cannot buy it in the long run, because science is produced by loyalties between teachers and students. You have no such loyalty, because you leave this and become a businessman. I haven't found any one student in this college in 20 years. That would be impossible in Europe. You don't care. You don't go on with what you learn here. You are not a future teacher. You are not in an academy nor in a university. You're just in a school. Because in a school, you do with what you learn as you please. In an academy, you do what the subject matter requires. And the subject matter requires further study and meditation. This you do not know. And the people who are drilled here and teach us colleges certainly don't know it. They just are turned toward a method. And then they go out and drill these poor children in progressive education. But gentlemen, the academy is therefore something between a school and a university. It means that the time in which a thought, an idea, a science is developed is unknown beforehand. It is not true that everything can be taught the next day. So will you kindly take down, in the academy, the time element is placed inside the academy and not into the world. You cannot call these academicians to order because it doesn't deliver the goods, gentlemen. And society that says you have to deliver the goods can't get goods, but it can only get the semblance of goods. You can, of course, ask such a man to popularize or prostitute his science. And if you bribe him sufficiently, like Emerson, who he says it was a bargain with Chicago, they paid me $1,500, so I went, I shouldn't have gone, but that's too much money. So, and he wanted to say, you can't tell this to such a large audience the truth. It's impossible, but if you pay me enough, I'll try. You already think you can have everything if you just buy tickets. You can't. Would you kindly keep this in mind, gentlemen, because it leads to a redefinition of those of you who have written this paper of Plato. They mentioned, really, what he did by founding the academy. Gentlemen, in 40 years, he was spanked and tortured and pilloried because he tried in his eagerness, as any teacher before had tried to do, to teach the people who were his contemporaries. And he found that his contemporaries just wouldn't accept it. First Socrates was executed, you all know this. And then the tyrant in Sicily didn't accept it and sold it into slavery. And on it went. And so when he died, he had resigned himself that the wisdom which he had deposited in the world would have to be carried on by a group of friends in the academy. And that's like a monastery, gentlemen. It is not a part of the political world. In this sense, gentlemen, the academies are mental preformations of the church. It's outside the real world. But it isn't different from the church because it has no ways of imposing its ways on the world by sacrifice, as the priest says of the monk by his vow, because sacrifices make an impression on the world. Anybody who gives up something like smoking or television does something to the world, he changes the world. Sacrifices change the world. But the academy did not change the world because it didn't ask for anything else but by staying
upon. It's a halfway house, the academy. And as such, the modern academicians have called the life of the academician. It's a halfway house, gentlemen, preparing possible other new solutions, but not imposing it on the world and not being sure that anybody of the century in which they live will listen, hoping against hope that there will be a time when people will listen. And for that time, the academy is ready, stands ready to offer solutions. In this sense, you must imagine, gentlemen, that the academies of Europe from 1450 to 1939 have stood ready, made ready, to be able to empower the rulers to throw atom bombs. That is to make energy out of matter, which is much better than atom bombs. You call all this bomb throwing, you see, with such a villainous name. It is the dream of mankind to be master of matter. And everything in this country, which is just a big Macy's, is deteriorated, it's ruined. I mean, if the American bought the bomb, people would now speak of men's mastery over matter, over nature, over that part of reality which doesn't speak. And that would be a perfectly positive claim. Here it has been tainted by its military purpose. But don't forget that it's a tremendous item. It's a tremendous achievement. It's the 400 years of natural science, gentlemen, which it has taken to understand that the problem was not to make gold, but to make energy. And gentlemen, all natural science then begin in 1450 with the dream of mankind to be an alchemist. That is to produce gold, which at that time seemed to be the foundation of the world, of man. And you must not forget that the atom bomb is the form of the dream of making gold which developed in 400 years of academic studies. But we are still chemists, and chemistry is nothing but the purged name, purified name of alchemy. So 400 years, gentlemen, it has taken to make the bomb. And if I want you today to get a little bit of the respect for the march of science, it's not a one-year enterprise. It's not a five-year enterprise. And if you 10 times now eliminate Mr. Oppenheimer, you will still have to respect the centuries of devotion of which he is the last link. He is a man devoted to science, a typically academic man. They are all very poor politicians. The Academy in Florence, gentlemen, peeled the concept of nature out of its previous ancient pagan wrappings. The new term nature, which you use, has nothing to do with the use nature in antiquity. There is a book by Cicero in antiquity, for example, on the nature of the gods. Such a book could not be written since 1450 because the modern nature does not include the gods. Plato, in his in his laws and in his dialogues, and Aristotle, in his politics, they were both theologians. That is, they included religion into that which had to be investigated as the physical parts of the universe. And to them, physis, gentlemen, will you kindly take this down to? Physis was the growing garden of Eden. Physis, P-H-Y-S-I-S, from which our modern word, metaphysics, physics, physiology, psychochem, all these words with physics, meant to them the same what it meant for the Jews to speak of Eden in the Old Testament. That is, physis included in antiquity God, men, and things. You could Plato, or you should Plato to understand him, called a theologian. And he has been called in antiquity this way. Plato is a theologian. He's not a philosopher in your sense of the word.
Whereas in Dartmouth College, and will you kindly contrast this, Plato is a theologian because his idea of nature, or physics is a Greek word for nature, includes gods, men, and things. The nature, since 49 and 50, is reality minus gods and men. It's a purified thing, it's a reduced thing. Now you can understand then that the Renaissance of the 15th century, gentlemen, of which you talk so much without knowing what it did, love, the ancient word, is the love of antiquity, using that which the Greeks had done well and omitting that which they had done badly. The Greeks had slavery. They had no woman's rights. They had eternal war. Therefore, modern men could not accept their doctrine on men. They had idols. They had statues of gods. They had fantasies, fantastical myths on the gods. Therefore, we had to strip in our Renaissance the Greek tradition from all this nonsense about Zeus and Hera. So we could only accept their careful study of the plants and the animals and the stars, their astronomy, their physiology, and their great observational character qualities. In philosophy, in 58, I have given. Who is anybody in 58? Well, there I have given a great story of the greatness of Greece with regard to these observations of reality around Greece, something that the Jews never did because they concentrated on their divine worship and they didn't look at the things for their own value, so to speak. But if you read Aristotle, you find that plants and animals are so classically described that when the modern greatest botanist of the 18th century, the Swede Carl Linnaeus, wanted to write his famous classification of plants, he for many years as a boy already, in his youth, studied Aristotle and improved on Aristotle's classical description of plants. You see, he took his whole style from Aristotle because with regard to the description of non-speaking things, the Greeks are ideal, integral. So, gentlemen, the nature of the Renaissance is purified of gods and men. And the Renaissance, perhaps you, is worth your while to take this down, gentlemen, because there's an endless confusion today about this. The nature of the Renaissance is that the Academy of Plato was reborn with regard to the observation of facts, but not with regard to politics and religion. The Renaissance omitted, will you kindly take this down, omitted the dealing with church and state of Plato. It concentrated on his mathematics and on his understanding of the natural world. The same of Aristotle, must be said of Aristotle. So I repeat what I said last time, gentlemen, that the modern academic world reduces nature to the reality minus the speaking element of the universe. When your conscience speaks to you, that's not a question of nature. I enter this class, gentlemen. We close the room.
The windows are unfortunately
audible. We are here a piece of nature at this moment. What is the only thing, gentlemen, in this moment which is not natural in this room? Which nobody who observes us from the outside can predict and measure. What is this? The world that I see next. Even I am just a corpse, gentlemen, going to die very soon. But not what I see. I keep you living and going by that which the man who looks into this with his telescope doesn't know. What I'm going to say next. You can actually test this, gentlemen.
By, you can describe us here just as a little microscope of the zoological universe. Everyone has some features of an animal. In men, you know, foxes and lions and ravens, and everybody reappears. Some are chicken-hearted, some are wolf-hearted, some are ravenous, like ravens, and so on. In humanity, as you know, the whole zoological and botanic kingdom is repeated. The women look like all the flowers in the world, and the men look like all the animals in the world. It would be quite a good attempt of you to draw us all here in picturesque style as the animals we come nearest to. But the speaker, gentlemen, defies all caricatures of men. The speaking man has something superior to the animal world. And while I speak, gentlemen, I know one thing. I may be as ugly as I can and as ridiculous, but I don't look like a beast when I speak. I'm not natural. To speak is what the philosophers call to transcend nature. And perhaps this is your only way of understanding this terrible word, transcend. That is, you and I, in the moment where we can speak, we fight the death, the thermodynamic law, the disintegration of the natural world. The natural world, gentlemen, ends in death. And speech is in the world to fight death. That's why you get an education. Because you must help us to overcome the dying society of America at this moment. Because everything nearly natural is doomed. There is nothing natural that can last. Nature ends in death, and speech ends in resurrection. That's why you must understand that the academic world is only one third of the world that deserves to be investigated. The academic world, I try to tell you, has been placed inside the university after people had studied how to speak to each other. And that was inherited from the academic people. The free discussion, the toleration of different doctrines, the love for each other, young and old, that the young should serve up to become teachers themselves and not just be drilled in West Point to become apes of military tradition. So, gentlemen, the academic spirit is Plato because it sets aside dynasties of academicians. Wherever you get dynasties of science, you get more than a school. But you don't get a university already. This you have to take from the Middle Ages. I now want to give you three examples of the working of the academic tradition. Was first, the simplest for you perhaps to understand, is the dynasty of the four generations who discovered the heliocentric system in astronomy. There were four men who had to follow each other before you and I now assume that the Earth turns around the sun. And by being four, I prove my point that the academic spirit is not a spirit of a school, but of an institution of higher learning for which society has to make room, which you cannot buy, but for which you have to wait. And where every member of the dynasty, gentlemen, enters with a free, miraculous decision. Gentlemen, the miracle of science are the scientists. It is not miraculous that you can make the bomb, but it is a miracle that in every generation one scientist came with a docta ignorantia, with a learned ignorance, to say we don't know enough, I have to begin from scratch. That is the miracle, gentlemen. Since the Renaissance, gentlemen, the miracles of life are not taking place between the in the streets, but in the life of the scientists. The scientists are the miracles. They cannot be predicted. You can never predict the scientists. This you do not understand, that's why you live in a dead prison of your own making. You live in a dead house of foxes. Because to you, all things, everything is natural. You can't see that all over. You have never understood that the man who says everything is natural, while he is saying this one sentence, is not natural. The sentence, everything is natural, is not natural. The sentence, everything is relative, is not relative. Therefore, Mr. Einstein is a miracle in a world of relativity. Because he tells the truth. And the truth is not relative. The first man of this dynasty in astronomy was Copernicus. Copernicus was a canon of the Cathedral of Danzig in so-called Western Prussia.
It's now Polish again.
And he died in 1543, as I told you, while his book on the revolutions of the heavenly bodies went out to the Emperor Charles V in Spain and was dedicated with the dedicatory first page to the Pope Paul in Rome. It disputed the Ptolemaic solution of the order of the universe and suggested that it was a simpler explanation to assume that the Earth turned around the sun. But Copernicus could not prove this because he could not explain the so-called epicycles, the cycles within cycles, which the planets describe. The planets do not describe perfect cycles around the sun. Therefore, it wasn't so simple as you now think to say, well, let's turn the whole thing topsy-turvy and stand our heads and look through our legs. As you know, then the Earth does appear very different. You think it's just such a hypothesis which made the new hypothesis. That's the new theory. That's not true. Copernicus had to admit that he could not explain the irregularity of the movements of the planets around the sun. But he suggested that one might look in this direction. That's all. That theory was debated, hated, rejected, but some adhered to it. For example, a friend of Shakespeare adhered to it, Mr. D, D-E-E, in England, an astronomer at the end of the 16th century. But it was an opinion, an hypothesis, and we couldn't prove it. Then there came a man who was a violent opponent of the Copernican solution, and his name was Tycho Brahe. He was a Dane. Copernicus was a Pole.
Oh, if my fellow countrymen the Germans hear this, I have to say he probably was a Pole.
Brahe lived in Copenhagen. And the King of Denmark was so impressed by his readiness that he built him an observatory,
an Urania, as it was called. For the first time,
something to study the heaven. Uranus is the heaven. You have a Urania, haven't you, in New York? Or is it called the planetarium? Well, that's a smaller word. What it really is this. In Europe, you have places in Vienna, for example, very famous, also in Berlin, called uranium from Uranus. Now, modern uranium is very modern again today as an element in chemistry. But uranium means heaven, the heavens, the sky world. And this is an astronomical term. Now, Tycho Brahe built such a uranium for himself. And for 40 years, he collected data of observation which had not been done since the days of Ptolemy. And here you see that the Renaissance of the 16th century and 15th century consisted in following in the wake of Plato and looking for yourself again. Neither the Arabs, nor the late Romans, nor the medieval monks had been able to establish the same continuity in observation in which the ancients already had made progress. Gentlemen, the occasional observations have all been made at all times.
But to observe facts through 30 years, that takes a budget. And you have to win over the interest of society, because you cannot do 30 years a certain thing without somebody cooking your meals. Somebody giving you the support. And for this, then, gentlemen, you discover that the academic world relies on an interest of society in allowing academic business to do useless work, research, useless work. It is not true that society supports science because it is useful. As soon as you think this, you have no science. You must believe in the miracle, gentlemen, that the useless is the most useful. The idea of Plato is that leisure, which is the Greek word skole, school, that leisure is so ennobling that men will put leisure to use, to unheard use. But gentlemen, will you take this down? The use that the man of leisure makes of his leisure is beyond any use known before. Therefore, the society can never understand what the scientist does. It will always call what he does useless. I'll give you a very famous story. Lionel Rothschild was the youngest son of the great banker's family in London, of the Rothschilds. These very rich people who made their fortune in the Napoleonic Wars. And the banking house of Rothschild is well known all over Europe. They will have branches in Frankfurt, in Paris, in Vienna. And Lord Rothschild was a member of the House of Lords. A year said he wanted to study zoology. And the family was dismayed and said that's nothing practical, useless. And then they were even more dismayed when he said he wanted to go to Tibet and investigate a certain flea. Now that was the limit, so they disinherited him and said that they didn't want to risk the finances of this famous banking house on such an agent. But he left, and he went to Tibet, and he studied the flea, and he discovered that this flea was a carrier of the bubonic plague. And that's why there is no bubonic plague any longer in the world. And that's a great story, gentlemen, if you would only notice what it means. It means that no public contemporary opinion can ever judge the enterprise of the scientist. And therefore, gentlemen, if you ever have a General Groves or now this terrible man Louis Strauss to judge Mr. Oppenheimer's science, then we are lost. If you have to prove to a general or to an admiral why you are doing something, then he will always support the stupid project and always reject the really scientific project. Because how can he understand? Gentlemen. I could give you a chapter on this on my own experience in my own life on this. It's just unbelievable. But this is why science in this country is in such danger, because it depends on foundations. The foundations is run by administrators, and the administrators are contemporaries, but they are not scientists. And therefore they are always on the safe side, and they always support this more stupid project, the more obsolete project, always the project of yesterday. I have told it many times that they, for the example, still support projects on cancer, which are just cut out according to Mr. Pasteur's idea of 1880. This is 1954. Can you assume anything more obsolete than to investigate cancer with methods developed 74 years ago for dog's bite?
How do you call it?
How do you spell it?
Yeah.
But that's done all over the place in this country. Always something analogous that they can understand. You see, if a man today comes with cancer and says, oh, I treat it like Pasteur, he says, oh, I've heard of Pasteur, so boy, I saw the movie. You see, this I can understand. So he gets 10 years. That's why science is so expensive in this country, because 99% goes down the sink. Impossible project.
science have nothing to do with the progress of science, but with the conscience known, and by these foundations they must get rid of it. You see? And so they give it to the most degenerate fellow who is just the grandson of Mr. Pasteur. But science doesn't go by grandsons. It doesn't go by flesh and imitation and by learning by rot. It gets by boldness and originality. So you think, well, the wonderful college professors don't belong there. They have no courage. They are not bold. They want to be spacey. The alumni must recognize them as good men. Now, an alumnus cannot recognize a bold man as a good teacher for his son. He wants to play safe. Ten years ago, I made a student of Dartmouth into a scientist. His father went immediately to the president and said, I had influenced his son and I had to be dismissed. I was a communist. Because the boy had an idea of his own. It's very dangerous to deal with an alumni. It's even dangerous to deal with you. Because you also want to be a one of the many. You want to conform. You want to. You don't feel happy if I say something that isn't conform. I have, however, to try to get one or two of you to support the real endeavor of society to keep free. Free from, not free from externally, but free from its own routines and prejudices. I have to appeal to somebody among you who understand that life is always in danger of dying. And I speak to you, gentlemen, in order to resuscitate some life. And not this derivative life of just repeating always the same jokes and the same how do you do phrases, you see. While you are dying, and I ask you how do, you still say fine. Don't you do that all the time? I just met a dying person the other day on the street, and she looked at me and she said, I'm fine. Live just in this prison of repetitive utterance. Who's ever said something original? And life is only with the original, gentlemen. With the words spoken in order to end this misery of the moment, which is dying. Now, Tycho Tycho Brahe was allowed by this king of Denmark to give 40 years to this nonsensical study of data among the stars. And he had innumerable papers, lists, and facts written down. And as I said, he was an enemy of the Copernican theory that he observed. And he was the first man to do this, as I said, in 500 years or 600 years of human history. Whereupon, Tycho Brahe had to leave his country for some external reason and came to Bohemia, only to show you how migrating academic knowledge is. He didn't stay. There was no university coming, it was just an observatory. Copernicus was dead by this time long ago in Poland. And this was in Bohemia, in the city of Prague. And in Prague, there was a man called Kepler, who came from Sweden, from Germany, from Ulm. And Kepler came to know Tycho Brahe, the old man, and said, may I use your data, your figures? And he saw that these figures bore out the Copernicus contention. And with a tremendous imagination, devotion, and piety, all great scientists have been religious people, gentlemen. He saw that the glory of God could now be served, as he expressed it himself, in a new vision of the order of the heavens. There's a very wonderful chapter in which he says this is a new sign in the glory of God. Because he recognized the elliptic character of the motion revolutions of the planets. As you know, we know that they do not describe a pure circle. So he did away with the Ptolemaic epicycles. Who has heard of this before? You must have heard this. All right, I just remind you. And saw that there was a mathematical equation
by which he could explain the Martian, the evolutions of Mars especially.
That was his first great discovery.
And in this enthusiasm, he proved the Copernican theory with the modifications that the Earth did not turn simply around the Sun, but in certain ways, which were simpler than the cycles and epicycles assumed by Ptolemy for the reverse. That's all we know today. It may still not be the final solution. Perhaps the whole solar system is dependent on larger, and a larger revolution in size. So, as you know, there are people today who are skeptics and say it makes no difference whether we say this, the Earth turns around the Sun or the Sun turns around the Earth. It's just relative. I'm not going to into this now, but I want to give you the dynasty. Kepler uses then the facts collected by an opponent of the Copernican theory to modify the Copernican theory and thereby to prove it. And the fourth man is Galileo, the only man of whom you really seem to know, always in this country, that has deep reasons of neglect. You all begin the Renaissance with this damn fool Bacon of Verona, and who did nothing. He was a journalist, the Mr. Kemper of his day. And but it's just as well, you see, if you appear in the New York Times, the people think you're very important. Like this Mr. Kemper, who's a very good writer on natural science, but just he doesn't discover anything himself. And so did Bacon. He was wrong in everything he presented himself. But he became popular, and that's why you date all knowledge from 1600. Now that isn't so. At that time, the old way of thought, this mere schools, gentlemen, of the universities, for the first time had to suffer the collision with the academic world. And we know, learn now that Galileo was the man who brought the thing to an issue. Galileo faced the Roman Catholic Church because of the textbooks for students. Neither Copernicus, nor Tycho Brahe, nor Kepler had any reason to think of students, because they were in the academic world, you see, all faithful, slow, continuous, and patient research, and didn't pay any attention to what the Jesuits or the Protestant ministers at that time taught in the schools to the boys. They learned the old stuff. But at one time, the textbooks had to be purged, and that comes only 100 years after the new ideas. And you will be surprised, you don't know it then. I will only influence the American textbooks in 100 years, because all the time, they won't make it an issue. They will just ignore what I have to say and my friends have to say. I'm out of the running because they are still hipped on their mechanic thinking, on their naturalistic thinking. That takes so long. Quite as old as I always hope to. Only when Galileo had this tremendous conflict with the church, became it public knowledge that there was such a strand. You find the same with all important movements, you see. The Jews existed centuries before anybody in Greece ever knew that they were there. Plato seems not to have known that Moses had lived. And certainly Seneca, the philosopher in Rome, and Tacitus didn't know anything reasonable about Peter and Paul and Jesus. The early Christians were quite unknown for 200 years in the world. When I grew up, gentlemen, in my family and in the world at large, Karl Marx and the socialists, Democrats, socialists were just so poo-poo that they were as though they had never existed. And as it was the same in this country, of course. They just hadn't existed. You don't know this, gentlemen, but science has a time and a world of its own, or it cannot form itself in its preliminary stages. So we get four men. Will you tell, you have them, I suppose, down, and will you perhaps take the trouble to say that they relate to each other with a simile, of course, just an analogy, like Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. Abraham already has a faith, but he cannot realize it. This is Copernicus. Isaac, as you know, is a very mediocre man who has in every way the opposite opinions for his father Abraham,
and a weak man like Lubra, but he has to fill out this period of waiting, of would you call this a period of incubation? Every academic idea, gentlemen, needs a period of incubation to see that Copernicus, the incubation that is the pregnancy. So we have conception and pregnancy, if you like, or you have incubation.
It's a more neutral term, and I think it is different as well.
For the insemination, for the first idea, and then the incubation. Then you get the conclusion, the birth of the fully ripened idea. What is it, gentlemen, what has happened in the incubation? It is saturated with facts. Tycho Brahe, 40 years of list of observations of star rises and star settings, you see, fill the idea of Copernicus with reality, with body. Just as a baby received from a male, you see, as a sperm, has to be filled with body, 5 pounds, 6 pounds, 7 pounds, so that the child may be born. Gentlemen, science is for the mind the parallel to birth in the physical world. A man in art and science conceives and is pregnant as a woman is pregnant with a child. If you have not this awe for your own mental world, this purity of conception, you can never be, neither be a scientist nor an artist. If you want to sell out as a bestseller, you cannot become an artist and conceive Dante's Divine Comedy. But you also cannot conceive of a new idea in science. That takes a complete seclusion. Just as a woman needs protection from the world while she's 9 months with child, gentlemen, so a scientist has to be with his child, this is brainchild, outside the world. That's the academic attitude. That's not the ivory tower, gentlemen, but that's the womb of time. Will you kindly take this down, gentlemen, that science needs a womb of time. Very serious science, gentlemen, and you must understand this. It is unknown in this country. When the war ended, there was a tremendous exhaustion, of course, all over Europe, and people discussed what they should do for the science and the educators there. And I pleaded with the American Foundation that they should allow these people to come over to America and to stay for a certain time in New Mexico or in Florida or whatever that would be best in the Rocky Mountains, Colorado, and have time. You know what they did? Took these men and made them give speeches and addresses in the great issue causes all over the country. And so they were dead on the ground after having already been exhausted, because leisure is not appreciated in this country as creative. I once was sitting in Paris at the Café de l'Opéra, across from the Palais Royal, with an American friend. And he suddenly turned to me and said, "Isn't it 3 o'clock in the afternoon?" "Yes, it's a wonderful hour. The sun is slowly setting. It was April, early." And you know, I got such a shock. I said to myself, if my boss in New York would see me sitting coffee at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, he would fire me. Yeah, I said, that's the difference. In Paris, there is leisure. And in America, there is. And therefore, gentlemen, these poor scientists, if they didn't die from pneumonia or jaundice, they certainly were completely exhausted when they returned to Europe, because you could not bring any foundation in this country to pay for leisure for these men, which they needed most. That's not in the program of any American foundation, that a scientist needs a womb of time. That's what he needs more than anything else. Oh no, make him make speeches. Applaud him. He's introduced by the conference, not one word of truth. All this spectacle, you see, they think that is creative. It's destructive. Leisure is creative. All this talk here, this women's club business, ruins all the good men you have. You want to ruin them. You want to see them destroyed, because you treat them by piecework. This is ignorance. We doctors can boast that did a very good job. It's just us. Us has asked, for example, or what for to live. That's for the honor of life. And our religion relatives. That's a very good job. And this must be examined in this process. Because that is the way in which you could honor creative life. By trusting men that their leader is much more valuable than their work. That's what is so hard to understand. Will you take it down, gentlemen? Artists and scientists are on the opposite end of a worker. A worker is paid for what he does. And a scientist and artist is paid so that he doesn't have to do anything. Because he saw it in a miracle that he does something that is not called work, that is not useful in the eyes of anybody, and that he doesn't know himself in the beginning. But it will happen to him. And in order that it can happen to him, you must set him free. He cannot go to his office at 9 o'clock in the morning.
I feel that I'm back
at that time. How who can know? Or go through the wall of woods, or something like that.
Leisure, gentlemen, is the great ground type of the academic mind. Leisure.
Because, as I said, the word is, that's the Greek word. Chole, that's in Latin, tell me, this is wrong.
It's right. And the Greek sigma.
So, this is Latin scola. We have made out of this word school. And that's why you have so much absences here, because you don't know it's a privilege to have this leader hour with you.
You think it's a school, but you stay away. Because school is where to be avoided. Leader is the situation to be solved, because it exposes you to infinite possibilities.
What can happen to you in this hour, you don't know. But certainly something that is fixed. But in a piece of work, you know exactly what you have to do. You have to deliver 5,000 words in a paper. Or some such stupid thing. So, Abraham, now we go on to Isaac. I already told you, Jacob is the energetic man, Kepler, who really brings the two periods of father and grandfather and the spirit together, and the Joseph who goes down to Egypt and becomes a power in the public eye is our friend Galileo Galilei, the Florentine physicist, who has the open crush with the authorities, just as Joseph in Egypt, and you know who was sent to prison for his story with the lady there, Potiphar's wife. But also became chancellor of the empire and became renowned. And after Galilei, the thing couldn't be kept silent. That is the importance of Galilei. After Galilei, everybody was, you see, it was the talk of the town. Before, it was the secret of the people who did it. Now, if you look back into the Jewish history, nobody in the world of their days knew who Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob were. You were just herdsmen, patriarchs. They had not didn't make history, you understand? History, the only man who made history is Joseph. If you had asked in the who is who of 1500 BC, they would have not noticed Abraham because he had no house on Park Avenue. So, gentlemen, the ways of the spirit are eternally very interesting. It always takes three generations before a really new issue can come into the public limelight. This is a very practical knowledge for you, gentlemen. If you want to raise a good family, if you want to understand America, you must understand that the good, great people, Jefferson and Washington, you find all in 1776, all look back to three generations of quiet American family life. In which nobody had ever spoken of any one of their ancestors. You take it for granted that these founding fathers already were people of good family. Well, I assure you, when their great grandfather landed in this family, they were not good family. They were just broke, and broken out, probably. There's a great story to this effect about the religious Protestant church in this country, gentlemen. In 1716, men landed in this country from North Ireland, Scotch Presbyterian, and settled in Pennsylvania. And he established a log cabin, and he had eight sons, and the eight sons had six friends, and he educated these 14 people.
And you have never heard of him, of course, because you only look at the limelight and never at the roots, at the seed, and the incubation. But this is one of the greatest men in America.
He's one of the sons, preached the famous sermon, I think it was in 1739, on the dangers of an unconverted ministry. And that led to a split between the church in New Jersey and New York and in Pennsylvania, and created the great revival movement all over America at that time. This revival movement created the style for the election campaigns of your political existence in this country. And 40 years before the revolution, that is, the American people went through the experience how to be ecstatic for 4 months. We are now in a secular form by climbing each other from July to November. But, gentlemen, without the elections and your belief that the will of the majority is at that moment the will of God, we couldn't run this country. It's one of the most strangest taboos in the world that American people believe that a candidate must not come into the limelight before the end of June, and then everything is settled on the first Tuesday of November, and on Wednesday nobody mentions any of the other candidates. You know that doesn't exist in any other country in the world. And it was created by the revivalists. And the revivalists were created in the Log Cabin College in Pennsylvania. And the Log Cabin College was founded by a man called Gilbert Finnan. And perhaps you notice his name because he is the Copernicus of the American political history. Gilbert Finnan, T-E-N-N-A-N-T. And because he is so important, no American textbook ever mentions him. Because this country knows only of the best crimes of the frontier. And they are quite unimportant. They bear no fruit. A crime is a thing that by its very nature cannot bear fruit and has no incubation. But what I have told you, gentlemen, is a true story of America. You get Gilbert Kennedy, you get his son, you get the people educated in the revival, and then you get the habits for the election of the Continental Congress in 71, 74, and 75. And that's why you know how to write the thing. And that's the story. And there was nothing in the 17th century which had any similar character, because there were no revivals, and people didn't wallow in enthusiasm for 3 months and were friends with everybody, you see, trying to get votes. Of course, if you understand the political campaign, it's the secular form of this story. But Gilbert Kennan, you know what his great idea was? That in every generation, the spirit should have the same force as it had in the Pilgrim Fathers. And as the Pilgrim Fathers had the faith over in Europe before they came to this country, and they're brought by the storm and tempest to this country on the basis of this, their own, you see, high pitch of emotion. The high pitch of emotion had to immigrate to this country too. And being an immigrant himself, Gilbert Tennant said, these people who are born in America, they are also people. They are also, you are also. And you have to get the spirit of your ancestors who crossed the ocean. But unfortunately, this spirit has to be brought over especially into your body. Your parents painted while they were seasick on the boats. So when they landed, they had already lost half of the spirit. Because it took them to take such a toll. So you don't receive it. You only receive it in this high point of the American political life in the election of them. Then everything suddenly different. And if you don't respect this gentleman and never have a revival yourself, you cannot become an American. Gilbert Kennan has created that element of American history by which American history is a constant recreation from its cradle in Europe. Can you understand it? And there you see
that this is not a part of naturalism. Your natural history of Ananda begins in this sentence. The true history of it begins when people began to dream and to speak of Ananda and you. And I told you last time, you see, that the natural nature is that which we are without feet.
Or without feet.
And that's why whatever man is used to born. And that's why Gilbert Tennant has not the central place in your textbook on Ananda history. Because they think they should treat Ananda history, and I can show you, you can treat this statue by looking at it from the outside. And not waiting what I have to say next. And not knowing what brought you into this room. These are the two words that have to be spoken. One word is philosophy. That's spoken out there, because otherwise you will tell you. And the natural animal who just smells the bad odor in this aroma at this moment doesn't know that you were quite enthusiastic that you signed up for the book.
You didn't know what you were getting.
And I'm saying something now. And these are the two things that are outside nature. But they create a womb of time, both of them. Because they make you come in for 4 months into this room, sticking to it. And they make me ask you to join the army of people who have thought before you and after you. And if I can do this, gentlemen, I have created you into a partnership with all the generations of scientists before and after. If I don't succeed, you see, I have discovered and something is destroyed. The womb of time is destroyed. The second point, gentlemen, the academies, we are at first just talking about Plato's idea of the universe. You can see from the dates, 1455, the first Florentine Academy, Tycho Brahe and Kepler and Galileo working only in 1600, down to 1620s and 30s, from 1543. So, gentlemen, what happened was that these miraculous free thinkers, free creators, and the places in which Plato's memory was celebrated and his books had to get together. And this was done in the 17th century by the creation of academies for the science, natural sciences for research. And you know of the French Academy, and you know of the so-called Royal Society in England, which is the most typical academy of the 17th century. The Royal Society in London was founded in 1665. The Academy in Paris was founded in 1635. But the Royal Society is a pure academy of the new type, which Paracelsus had invoked when he said, you have to go everywhere to every part of the globe and report the observed facts there and collect them back by correspondence. I told you that academies need corresponding members. Now the Royal Society in London to this day, gentlemen, consists of corresponding members in the main. And a little center group which communicate the correspondences to the letters and members and residents and then print the so-called proceedings. Now the word proceedings, gentlemen, is a scientific term for progress, for that which proceeds, which goes forward in factual information. The word proceedings of any academy is therefore an insignificant term. You know the word process today.
Don't think these are process cheese, that's regress.
But the word process means that a mental process, a thing, is not considered statically but dynamically. When we are in process, you see, we are growing. We are not repeated or repetitive. Therefore, the word process and proceedings are very important books.
They're words
because they say you may deal with facts, with stones, but your own mind must be a process. Your own mind is not just a photographic.
And how do you call it? Photographic
plate. But it is working. It is developing. It is growing. It is changing. It is proceeding. So the word process belongs to an academy, rightly, because it means that the academy at every moment has a kaleidoscope of facts and a constant demand to reorganize these facts. Every minute you have a different state of science, a different code of behavior. Today the doctor has to tell you, we must operate. Everybody operates. I got a famous queer letter the other day from England. A girl had a girl, 25, had two large tonsils, and she was going to be operated on, and the English doctor said they wanted to have total anesthesia. And the parents living in Europe on the continent wrote to me and said, this girl, in English, under English scientific rule, will have a total anesthesia, but she has a weak heart, and he really thinks that's terrible, and she should have a local anesthesia. And would you kindly inquire of the American doctors what they think is right, what to be done in this case? Well, I said, really, this is wrong. I mean, I cannot dabble with medicine over the ocean. But it so happened that I ran into one of them, the doctor here at the concert, and they said, well, Dr. Henry's clear demand, if you hear the answer, I'm very pleased to give it, pass it on, and without benefit of clergy, and and he said, well, as a matter of fact, we prefer local anesthesia, that's much you can say, but there are exceptional cases in which we have to also to do total anesthesia. So I was just as clever as I wanted to be. It was, you see, one way or the other, which is always the same. I reported. So the question was solved in a very interesting way. They took the daughter to the continent and had her operated there according to the standards of the continent by local anesthesia. Well, the case is just clear, but it means that the doctors of any one time and country are under the impact of a ethical code. 50 years ago, there was no anesthesia. But the tonsils had to cut out without anesthesia, you see. 30 years ago, the only thing that existed was total anesthesia. Therefore, you had to take out the tonsils with total anesthesia. Today, we have local anesthesia and total anesthesia, so you can be doubtful about it, you see. But these are three times for academic decisions of scientific character, you see, preliminary to the operation itself. And you see how the mind of the academic world has to proceed all the time. In other words, gentlemen, science is nothing you can quote of yesterday. When science is popularized, you always know the science of yesterday. What you think, for example, about evolution is just sheer nonsense. That's obsolete. Nobody believes it anymore who's really doing real research. And so on. But you are the cultural life, my dear friends, because you go to schools in which you hear the science of yesterday. But the man who has to operate on a patient must have the science of this moment. Otherwise, he's immoral. And he can be, if he would deal with the tonsils as the doctor could do 50 years ago, you see, without anesthesia, he would be called, you see. What would he be called?
50 years.
If he treated the person as a doctor 50 years ago, then how would he be treated? Oh, no more than that. Don't you think his life would be destroyed? No, the medical association would intervene. The doctors would say he's not a doctor. That's much worse. They would call him in fact. That is the world. They would say, you are not my colleague, you are quack. Gentlemen, that's very important. The truth about God must be the same through all times, because he is the power who keeps us going progressively from generation to generation. God created science, for example. He made you and me capable of joining the army of truth seekers, because men have sought for the truth from the beginning of time. Otherwise, you couldn't speak English. The grammar of which you speak is reasonable. And they did right in creating it. Otherwise, everything we say would be nonsense if there was not 1, 2, 3, 4. They invented them, our ancestors, because they wanted to hide already part in the truth, to share in the truth, but they didn't have science in our sense, because science is that of the moment, which at this moment has proceeded so far, it is expected to proceed even further. Can you see this? Because it deals with the changing universe, with that part of nature which is not the same all the time.
You don't believe it, I know. You still think God is just nature.
But you and I can only speak of nature because we are not nature. Now, gentlemen, the third thing, the academies split open into two parts. It was clear that the simplest thing for the academies was to observe the facts in the dead universe, the stars, the stones, the behavior of minerals, of the investigation into the layers of the earth, the crust of the earth, or geology. It's all a creation of the last 300 years. Nobody knew in the Middle Ages or Antiquity that there were different layers, you see, deposited in great periods of time. The fossils were quite known in the Middle Ages, but nobody formulated any logical conclusions, you see, of what had happened. So these are typical new sciences, gentlemen, who have sprung up in the academies, not in the universities, gentlemen. Not in the universities, but in the academies. The university was the enemy of all this new stuff at that time, because they were just going on with teaching young men, you see, and not doing any research in the things of the world. That wasn't the business of the universities at first. But these academies had also tremendous facts. There were people in China who spoke Chinese. There were Latin texts. There were Greek texts. There were Hebrew texts. So they added to the mathematical, philosophical section, a second section, which they called the philological and historical section. And it means to say, it means that in every academy where you go now through the world, you find two parts of their publications. One is filled with grams and pictures and graphs and lists and statistics and ways and measurements and new formulas in mathematics, non-Euclidean mathematics is probed into there and such things, and relativity is discussed and the uranium and the isotopics and so, and you have to touch there. And then you get another class of publications of the same academy in Berlin, in Vienna, in Paris, in the Royal Society, in London, Stigwood, on Edinburgh, Bologna, Rome, Naples, and even Philadelphia. And what is in this? Well, there may be an article on the Egyptian calendar by Mr. Winslow, who was some of the head of the Metropolitan Museum. Or there may be an article on a text of Cicero in an old manuscript found in, let's say, Verona, as it actually was found
in the last century.
And these correspondents in Verona, that was the famous Cardinal Angelo Mai, would send in to the academy in Rome and said, I found a new manuscript of a text, you see, of a Latin author in Verona, in the cathedral library there. And they would publish it there. That is, gentlemen, the letters or literature is language and history of people treated as nature. That's very important. What you call letter, Dr. Wood, or George Wood is Dr. and Bell Letter, as you may know in this college, treats the letters as dead, as monuments, which you can treat as archaeology, as just being what they are. And modern philology has treated the documents and monuments of the past as merely documents of the past. Just as you treat the Bible as something written by somebody else for somebody else. That's a very good definition, gentlemen. What people call philology means the treatment of a text as written by somebody else for somebody else. Now, if you read the Bible religiously, it is written for you by somebody who speaks to you. Is that right? If you treat the Bible as literature, in the same as course in the English department, It is treated as written by somebody for somebody else. And you look at it. Ladies, gentlemen, you learn from this department of letters, or in this college is called the humanities, because they are so inhuman, the treatise, Sigmund, that you can look into other people's bedchambers through the keyhole and ask yourself, what did they say to each other? You can be an observer. As the Americans were from 1990 to 1938 in the League of Nations in Geneva, you see, and you end up disastrously because it is shameless to be an observer. Not good.
Looking through the keyhole is like going to Berlin's show and seeing a stripteaser. And that's forbidden. Take the girl and go away with her. That's highly virtuous. But don't allow the stripteaser in your eyes before you. That is the miserable state, gentlemen, at this moment of our study of speech, history, and the great text of ours. That you read the Bible with the sneer of the expert who looks at somebody else's writing written for somebody else. If the Bible is written to you and me, don't read it. For heaven's sake, what's the matter? What do you have to do with such an old book written 59 years BC? Nonsense. It's poison. It's much better that you have never heard of it. The only hope in this country at this moment is that we'll pass a law very soon that nobody is allowed to read the Bible before he's 40 years old. Because if he's 40 years old and then reads the Bible for the first time, he will read it with a burning interest, as written for him. But you read it as literature. You are told that this was written 500 BC by somebody in trouble, Prophet Isaiah or Jeremiah, and he was a very cantankerous curse, and most of the tradition is wrong anyway. Half of it was forged, and the Jews didn't like it, and we don't like it either. So, gentlemen, I'm very earnest now. From 1500 to 1900, the world of speech has been relegated to an observable fact. And therefore, it has been treated as dead. And that's why you have a wrong view of American history. You have a wrong view of Shakespeare. You don't go to Henry IV's second part. No, you don't. There were more actors at one time here in the performance on the stage than in the audience. Because Dartmouth students don't have to go to hear Shakespeare because they think he has not written for them. That's just a curiosity. You have a course on Shakespeare in which you are taught this way. That's a poor play, we were told. That's a typical treatment of an academic mind. It is utter nonsense. Because the worst play by Shakespeare is still better than the plays you write in the opportunities contest. So you live in a dead universe, gentlemen, because even the history of America has been debunked and is written for. You look into it and you say all the speeches made by Daniel Webster were addressed to stupid people, we wouldn't be taken in by Daniel Webster. But gentlemen, you have some exceptions. The farewell address, the letter from Washington, and the Declaration of Independence and the Gettysburg address, we still read as though they were addressed to us. Isn't that true? And what do we do then, gentlemen? We are not in the academic world. We are outside the womb of time for scientific research, and we are dealing with this as addressed to us. We are back in the speaking universe. I'm mentioning this, gentlemen, because you are so tragic creatures. You have no relation to science except idolatry. That if you say other people have science and I believe in it, I have no science and I don't care what, I want to make money. That's your by and large situation. You are neither a scientist, nor are you free from the scientific blight which transforms everything into death and dead matter. So you don't live with the Bible and Shakespeare and the songs of Longfellow and Tennyson or anybody else for that matter. Because you have heard the critics say, oh, that's nothing but Melville was a neurotic.
And so, you see, you know all about him. Or as I said, a colleague say in this college, oh, about Goethe, I can tell you everything about Goethe in 5 minutes. Now, gentlemen, that's academic, because if you can say everything about Goethe in 5 minutes, then you certainly don't have to read it. Isn't that true? To dismiss it as being on the heap of facts, of nature, of no longer speaking to you, and without any reverence. Gentlemen, the words which you and I must read are words which still wait for coming true. That is, every word that I try to tell you has future. And it isn't finished by your saying your first. When you go out of this plan to say today he said something positive, you have killed what I told you. You have killed it. Because the only remark you must make is it true? In as far as you ask this question, you decide whether it must live with you, because the truth you cannot give up. It must be unforgettable. You never ask this question. You only talk about whether I spoke lively or violently or wittily or such terminally ridiculous remarks. They tell of Schnabel, the great pianist, that once concert he played Beethoven, that he had bad luck with his chair. And so the chairs had to be exchanged 5 times before he could be seated. And then a friend of mine who attended this concert talked about the greatness of his playing later. He found that the only thing the people recalled were the chairs and this exchange of differences. And they hadn't been able to receive his message because he was a very great Beethoven player. And that's by and large how we treat my classes and all classes. Do you remember whether I had to change my chair? But that is not, that's why you are sort of in such a tragic twilight at that time. You neither are related to the truth, nor do you know what the truth, how the truth fits you into life. You want to be under the wings of science, but you haven't learned enough to participate in research in the progress of science. And yet science serves the one purpose that you are not baffled or not fettered by anything you say of the scientific research for me. So I don't have to admire, I don't have to be moved, I don't have to get excited. I can take it easy. And you have no participation in anything. And that's by and large your existence. And I don't think I have that question. Because you have made up your mind that this should be done. You don't wish to be excited. Don't get excited, it's everything you say to each other. Isn't that true? I've never heard a student say to each other, get excited. The only thing you say to each other is, don't get excited. And thereby, you imitate the scientist who, for the sake of trying to investigate all the dead matter, has to get as dead as the matter. He investigates. But gentlemen, you ought to know that what he investigates is only part of the science, of the world. Over the existence of a real scientist, you should get passionate about. Because the scientist, in his asceticism, in his renunciation of immediate success, in his patience, in his courage, he is a very exciting man. Couldn't you be a little bit as exciting as him? This is your problem, then. I have to try to show you, gentlemen, the limitations of the academy. They have investigated the dead part of the world successfully. But they also have estranged you, by your idolatry of science, from all the living voices who have tried to excite you and still try to excite you. Because you carry over the department of research of dead matter, of nature, into the world of your human relations. Your parents, your teachers, the great books, and whatever it is, and you have no immediate voice contact with the people who have spoken for you only. There is no Christianity if Christ hasn't spoken to you. And there is no Bible if it is written for you. And there is no Gettysburg if it isn't addressed to you. There's no Shakespeare if it isn't written for you. If you say that Shakespeare was written for the Jacobite drama, it's a lie. The man was not appreciated in his time. Half as much as he should have. He was mistaken for one of the many. We know that he's the only survivor. We can only do it justly. If you don't listen to Shakespeare, he is guilty of his deserved success, that he is the voice of the past in which drama really came into its own. And a great theologian, Tholuck in Germany, has said that any human being must have two books in his home, Shakespeare and the Bible. And he meant to say, you see, one was the book of the world speaking directly to us, surviving the academic blight of Mr. Bacon of Verulam and Copernicus and Virgil Brahe and Galilei. Despite the fact that the earth turned around the sun, there are voices on this earth, gentlemen, which are more important than the turning around the sun. Shakespeare is you and my sun. And the Bible is the moon, if you like. And the Bible is the sun because there is something that these people have appealed to. What have they appealed to? They have appealed to a womb of time that you and I must form. That is, Shakespeare and the Bible make you and me into the equals of the scientists. Tycho Brahe, Copernicus, and Galilei and Kepler have formed the womb of time over 120 years. After that, astronomers came, and you take it for granted that it is an astronomical society, and there's the Lick Observatory, and how is the other called? In California. That's all for you, common knowledge. But they are just the heirs of this womb of time. And they are still in the same womb of time created in the 16th century. Now, gentlemen, in competition with all the scientists, you and I too live in a womb of time. We also have to create a good life. We don't dabble with these dead stars. We're higher than the sky. We deal with real children, with real people, with the Negroes and the Hindus and the Americans and the Germans and the Russians. And this is our share. We are better off than the scientists, I can assure you. But only as long as you read Shakespeare and the Bible, that is, as long as you are called into church and state, into a womb of time which is waiting to mature and to be give birth to new creatures of peace and joy and delight. And you do not feel that you are the equals of the scientists by listening to Shakespeare and the Bible. You are completely forgotten this. You really think that by imitating the scientist, by reading his step of relativity, that you become a teacher. Which you can never. You will always be a very little frog in the field of science. But you can all be their equals by forming a womb of time through history between free men. You can just as easily be as miraculous as Miss Einstein. Not by discovering relativity, you see, but by loving your neighbor as yourself, for example. And gentlemen, therefore, the academic world of science has always to be balanced by a world of poetry, of art. The last 400 years have transformed the monuments of creed into something natural. Under one condition, that you and I will be nourished by something living to keep us out of science, to preserve you and me as not objects of science, but as singers of the universe, as speakers of the universe, as unnatural. If you do not remain unnatural, then science will kill you. And how do you remain unnatural? By first of all, listening to the most living voices. And then by writing poetry yourself. By calling to a girl and then political speeches. What you like. But certainly by speaking and listening. By entering this great process of the trial. Give me one more minute. I'm wrong. I know I shouldn't give you. But look. I'm so present. Look, you remember my triangle of the mental processes. And he said that living man is a man waiting to be recognized so that what he thinks of himself and what the people tell him that they think of himself and what they say to each other, what I am, that this comes to an equation. That's life. Remember? That's all human speech. that the tremendous tension, temporality under which you and I live, that you are so interesting, that it's worth your consciousness, and it's worth other people's consciousness, and the judgment that other people pass over you, even when you ask. When they give you a place, when they give you a job, when they promote you, when they dismiss you, when they love you, when they invite you, when they support you, etc. All this is going on all the time. You are treated as a person, as a student, as an adult, and all the time by the others who speak about you for what you say also to them, and make them think about yourself. All this is abolished in the natural of the time. And therefore, gentlemen, this is the ending word today. Science is a tendency which cannot go unbalanced or unobstructed. Science is the tendency of treating everything as nature, that is, as reality without speech, as observable reality. And the arts are the contra-hunger movement of making you and me again feel that we are unique, that we should have self-consciousness, that our self-consciousness makes an impression on other people and forces them to think differently about it. So, gentlemen, the academic search is fatal unless it is balanced. And we are out of balance in this college because you do not go to Shakespeare, you do not go to Chapman, and therefore you are not receiving any life, but you are only allowing yourself to be treated objectively as an object of science. And the more you do this, the more